Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Rose, and I am an alcoholic. If anyone ever told me that I would be speaking at a state convention for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't think I ever would have believed them. I am truly blessed, and I am grateful to have been given an opportunity to do this. I want to thank the committee for asking me to speak, and my dear friends who brought me here today. It is an honor and a privilege to be a member of this program, and that's something I never thought that I would be able to say, because I never wanted to get sober. At the end of my drinking, I just wanted to die, because that was my answer. I never thought that a life like this was possible for someone like me, and yet here I am. It's important to qualify, so I'll do that. My sobriety date is January 12, 2001. I have a home group. It's the Arapika Step in the Right Direction group in Arapika, Florida. I have a sponsor, and I try to work the steps and apply them in my life today. When I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to go to a lot of speaker meetings. And I went for a couple of reasons. I went because I was petrified that somebody would call on me and ask me to speak in a meeting. And I knew for an hour I was safe. But I also went because it was important for me when I heard someone share their experience, their strength, and their hope, that they told me about who they were when they were drinking, because it was impossible when I was new for me to believe that the person standing here ever felt the way I felt, had ever done the things that I did. They looked well, they looked clean, they looked put together, they looked happy, and I was dying. And so it was really important for me to be able to identify with who they were when they first came in here, because I was so hopeless. I was so helpless. So I think it's important to tell you a little bit about where I come from. I'm originally from New Jersey. I'm 48 years old. I come from an Irish Catholic family. My mother's actually from Scotland. My father's Irish and German. And growing up, drinking was always a part of who we were. Coming from that type of cultural background, there was always drinking. If someone got married, you drank. If someone died, you drank. If there was a wedding, you drank. You just drank. That's what we did. So I always, even as a small child, associated drinking with something fun, something social, something friendly. I even remember, as a small child, tasting alcohol because my aunts and uncles would leave them on the table. And I don't recall ever liking it. I never was one who said, I love the taste of that. And to this day, I still don't like the taste of alcohol. I was truly a person who drank for effect. As a small child, I was painfully shy. I'm not just a little bit shy. I mean, so terribly uncomfortable in my skin. I used to hide behind my mother in the grocery store. I was petrified anybody would ever even talk to me. So long before I picked up a drink or a drug, I was a misfit. I never fit in. And what alcohol did for me was it made me feel normal. But I didn't know that at first. I just remained in this shy little shell of a life that I had. And I had friends, and I went to a little Catholic school. And my life wasn't terribly bad, and I didn't come from bad parents. But I was just always empty inside. I always felt like something was missing. I always felt like I wasn't pretty enough or good enough or anything enough. I just always was sad, and I was always blue. I don't ever remember being a happy child. I always remember just wishing I was someone else, looking like someone else, had someone else's hair. And I was an overweight child. I had bright red hair. I had a big gap in my teeth that you could drive a Volkswagen through. I mean, I was never the girl in school. I wasn't the cheerleader. I was just the girl, you know, and I just never felt good about Rose. I had two older brothers that I went to school with, and my brothers were everything in life that I wasn't. They were athletic. They were popular. They were smart. And it wasn't that I was dumb. I was just so incredibly shy I couldn't get out of my own way. You know, I wouldn't hand something in instead of, I was petrified it would be too good, or I was petrified it wouldn't be good enough. I was just always living in fear. And when I was 9 years old, my parents had another child. They had my little sister, Katie. And that changed my life drastically. I went from being the youngest child in my family and the only girl to being kind of lost in the sauce. I kind of just blended in with the background. I wasn't that special one anymore. You know, my little sister took my place, and I became very much of her caretaker. My mother and father are good, honest, hardworking people, and so I'd come home from school and I'd have to care for a little baby. because my mom had to work. I'd have to do my homework and start dinner. So I was an old woman before I even hit 10 years old. I mean, I'm not even in double digits, and I got a baby on my hip, and I'm cooking dinner and trying to do my math homework. So I was always older than I was. But I didn't have a bad life. Alcoholism does run in my family, but I can't blame it on anybody or anything. It was a choice that I made freely and purposefully. I don't say, well, I'm this way or this happened to me because of. I'm really clear, and I always have been, that the reason my life turned out the way it did was because of the choices that I made. I never blamed anybody else, and it's not because I'm a genius. I just always blame myself for everything, you know? I'm not good enough. I'm not smart enough. I didn't finish it. I didn't do a good job. I just always was blue and sad. My life started to change a little bit when I went to high school. I followed again my brothers to high school, and I went to Catholic high school as well. And I'd made a decision when I became a freshman in high school that I was gonna find an identity. I was tired of being Johnny and Tommy's little sister. I was gonna fit in, come hell or high water. I was gonna do whatever it took for somebody to notice me. Nobody ever noticed me. So I remember going to my first high school dance, and I remember asking my oldest brother Tommy if he would buy me beer before this dance, and he said, "Rose, I don't think that's a good idea." And I said, "Why? That's what you do. That's what everybody does." And I bugged him like little sisters do, and I made his life just a nightmare until he gave in, and he finally bought me that six-pack of beer. And I remember it as if it was yesterday. I remember drinking 3 Rheingold tall boy beers. And what I remember most is when I drank those beers, my whole perception of every single thing in my life changed. I wasn't too fat anymore, or not pretty enough anymore, or not smart enough, or not popular enough. I felt normal. I felt normal. And I knew from that very moment in time that I'd found my answer. I'd found my solution. It was nothing like I started out just having a couple of beers. Every single time I had an opportunity from the age of 14 years old to drink, I drank. And I didn't drink to cop a little buzz. I drank to get drunk. I'd found the answer. I'd found the very thing that made living in my skin bearable. I remember many times as a teenager contemplating suicide. And I think if it wasn't for my alcoholism, I probably would have. I think my alcoholism kept all those feelings that I had at bay. They quieted the beast that was inside of me and in many ways saved my life. I never drank successfully from the very first time. I drank alcoholically, like I said, from the beginning. And there were signs, you know. I'm just not a good drinker. By the time I was 15, I had my very first of many bouts of alcohol poisoning. Had to be rushed to the hospital. By the time I was 16, I was going to bars every single day after school. Going to the bars. School books, you know, in the car. Going in the bar. And I didn't have ID, but, gosh, if you know the bartender and you keep going there enough, they just assume you're old enough. And I always looked older than I was. So I got away with it. By the time I was 17 years old, my father sat me down and he said, "Rose, you have all the earmarks of being an alcoholic." And I knew it. I knew my father was right. I knew it was different for me. I knew I drank differently than my friends. I knew it was too important to me. They'd go out and worry about getting a case of beer. I had to get a case of beer and worry about the bottle that I had secretly stashed in my pocketbook because, God forbid, I had to share with anybody. I was always different, and I knew my dad was right. But I also knew that it didn't matter because at 17 years old, I had all the answers. I knew everything about everything. But I was absolutely certain of several things. I was certain that it was my life, and I was going to live it any way that I wanted to. And I was truly under the belief that I wasn't hurting anybody. I truly believed that my actions didn't cause consequences for anybody else. And I believed that for a very long time. I believed it actually even into sobriety until I started to do some work and saw how my choices, my words, my actions, my attitude affects the people around me. So as much as I knew the old man might have a point, it wasn't going to change what I was going to do, and I was probably figured I just got to be a little sneakier about this, got to be a little quieter about this. And I started doing a lot of closet drinking. By the time I graduated high school, and I always got good grades because my parents would have killed me. I mean, there was that fear. There was that parental fear in my house. I got out, and I figured, well, I better go to college because that's what you're supposed to do. And I did. I started a county college locally to where I lived. And about 2 months in, I realized it wasn't for me. I didn't realize at the time that this was the beginning of how I started to sell myself short, about how I traded my life, my hopes, my dreams, my goals for a drink. But I didn't see that then. I figured, you know what? I don't really like this gig. I'd rather go out to the bars. I want to play pool. I want to dance. By the way, I never played pool, and I never danced. I thought I did until a lot of the fog started to clear up, and I realized when I held a pool stick in my hand sober, I'd never done this before. So, but this was my thinking. You know, I'll go out. I'll earn a living. I'll make money, and I'm smart enough, I'm good enough, and I did. I started to go out and I started to work, and I loved working, because as much as I think as an alcoholic that I am, I'm a workaholic. Whatever I do, I put 2,000% into. You know, although there's a lot of unfinished projects I may start, but certain things like working, I threw everything into it because it became my identity, because I had no other life outside of my work. My work defined who I was, so I was very good at it, and I liked money. I loved money. A very materialistic person. I love what money can buy. I love shoes and pocketbooks. I love earrings and perfume. And I realized when I went out and I started working, I could do all these things. And I was living at home, paying my parents $20 a week rent. So I was free to do all these things and to live lavishly and to go out every night. And I did this for a couple of years, and then I met the man of my dreams. He was the older brother of a kid I'd gone to school with. And what attracted me to him was the fact that he drank exactly like I did. He didn't sip a drink at the bar. He drank. He just downed it right. And I was like, ooh, yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Because that's not, I don't like sissy little drinks. I don't like straws in my drinks. Please don't put any fruit mix in there. I like it hard and I like it straight. So I looked at this guy and I'm like, I could probably hang with him because I won't feel out of place when I'm with him. He's like me. And that was the come on. And so I started a 13-year relationship with a very sick alcoholic man that was toxic from the beginning. But when you're in the throes of your addiction, you truly believe you're in love. And so that's what I sold myself on that lie for a very long time. 2 years into our relationship, my parents and his parents got together and said, we need to break these two up because someone will die. And they were right. It was that sick. But we were in love. So nobody was going to break us up. So we were going to stay together in spite of everyone. We're an island. And the fact is, yeah, the fact is, we never dated. We drank. We never went to the movies, never went out to dinner. We drank. That's the entire basis of the relationship that I had with this man. When I was 25 years old, still living at home, still paying $20 a week rent, my mother and father decided to move to Florida and throw me out on the street. And so I decided the only thing for me to do was to move with this man. That made sense. So as much as I was an alcoholic already, full-blown, blackout every time I drank, when I started living with him, I started drinking more than I'd ever drank before. Because I didn't have to worry about sneaking in at 3 in the morning. Was my father going to catch me? Did I have to drive? Didn't have to worry about any of that stuff anymore. And I started drinking about 1.75 liters of whiskey every night. And working every single day. And I had a great job. I don't know how I got it, but I got it. And I don't know how I kept it, but I did. I worked for a very large Fortune 500 company, and I started out on the ground level, and I worked really hard, and I got raises, and I started making more money. And like I said, I was really dedicated to my job in many respects. As a sober woman, I can see where I really sold the company short, because I thought I was a great worker. But I really did work hard for a very long time. Well, as soon as I moved in with this man, he stopped working. And that's when I realized that I started to really just settle for anything in life. Good enough is good enough for Rose, you know. And soon after he retired from life, and we were living together, he started to become very abusive. He started to become very psychologically abusive, very verbally abusive. And eventually it led into some sexual abuse, and then it became a very physical abusive situation. And I was so sick myself, so sick, that I didn't realize that I could get out of this. I was so ashamed of what my life had become that I stayed in it for probably another 8 years, and it got progressively worse. He was a very sick alcoholic. He used to bleed from his varices. So every so often he would have to be rushed to the hospital, and then he would go to a detox and he would dry out, and then he would go to a rehab and he would get sober for a little bit of time. And of course, I never stopped drinking because my alcoholism is manageable. I pay the bills. Manageable. I go to work every day. Manageable. I can write a check for anything. Manageable. I have all the right clothes, all the right jewelry. I have a nice car. I have a beautiful place to live. Manageable. You can hide your alcoholism and your unmanageable life behind money for a very long time. And that's what I did, because I truly believed that he was the problem. I truly believed if he would stop drinking and he would get his life together a little bit, that my life was magically going to get better. It never occurred to me that I would have needed to stop drinking for that to occur, because I was too busy blaming him for everything. Eventually, if you were in a sick, toxic relationship like I was, and you were being abused like I was, you yourself become an abuser, and I did. I became verbally abusive. If he hit me, I hit him back, and it was usually with a large piece of furniture. He was so unpredictable that I used to, at night, I would stop, you know, on my way home from work, and I would stop at a drugstore, Walgreens or whatever they were back then, Rite Aid, I think we had in New Jersey, and I would buy over-the-counter sleeping pills, and I would crush them. And I didn't know that I could have killed him. I was just trying to buy a peaceful night, because it could have been a peaceful night, or something could have triggered him off, or the wrong thing could have been on television. So I never knew how my night was going to go. I lived in that unpredictability. Eventually, I'd had enough. He had made a variety of threats to me. He was going to kill my family. Wouldn't have bothered me, I don't think, if he said he was going to kill me, but he was always going to kill somebody I hurt. It's kind of like the mob. We're not going to hurt you. We're going to hurt your family. And I was so busy hiding my life from my whole entire family that I believed him. And I was so sick that I couldn't think for myself. And I stayed where I shouldn't have stayed. But I made a choice to stay there because I was afraid you would see me for who I really was. I was afraid the truth was going to come out. And Rose wasn't the delusional character that she had built you to believe that she is. Although my parents went to Florida to live, eventually when I was 25 years old and he had come out of one of these rehabs, he decided he was going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and he was going to get saved and life was going to be better. And I was like, whatever, great. And he asked me if I would go to a meeting with him. Now, I was 25 years old at the time, and I said, okay, great, I'll go. You know, because that's what a good woman does. She stands by her man because he's obviously got this big, bad problem. And I went to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with him, and it was a speaker meeting. And I remember it. There was a woman there. Her name was Debbie B., and it was in a hospital in New Jersey. And she got up there, and she introduced herself, and she started telling her story. And I didn't know that that was my first identification with another alcoholic. All I knew is she was talking about the way I felt my whole life. She was talking about situations that she wasn't able to handle when she drank, how her life went when she drank, and it was me. And I never thought I had been the problem. And after the meeting, she came up to me, and she did that very thing we're supposed to do. We are responsible. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, and I didn't reach out for help, she just knew. She could see it, probably because I was crying, that I was in so much pain. And she did what we're supposed to do, and she put the hand of AA out there and said, you don't have to live like this anymore. There's a better way. And she tried to help me. She became my sponsor. She dragged me to meetings. She said, don't drink and go to meetings. I didn't realize that was like a complete sentence. I drank and went to the meeting. I drank after the meeting. I drank. And she would grab me by the back, and she would say, you are so willful and defiant. Until you become willing and reliant, you will never get sober. And she was right. I fought everything. I didn't want anything to do with these kooks in AA. And I sat there, and I rolled my eyes. And eventually she said, you need to go to rehab. And I did. I went away for a 28-day program. You know, I found myself. I found God. I got the chip that said you're going to live the rest of your life sober. I got out. And within 2 months, I was drinking again, and so was the man I was living with. Because if you don't do the things that they say to do, you're destined to repeat the things that, I mean, if nothing changes, nothing changes, right? Sure enough, both of us are drinking again. The violence starts again. The neighbors are calling the cops. And I never told my parents that I'd relapsed after I got out of this rehab. I let them believe that I was sober. And it wasn't so hard when they're in Florida. I'm in New Jersey. You don't call them when you're drunk. Call everybody else when you're drunk. You just don't call mom and dad. What I didn't know was that every time the cops were called and came to my house for domestic violence, it was printed in the newspaper. And my brothers read the newspaper. And my brothers called my parents. So they knew. They knew all along. But they were waiting for me to tell them. And I wouldn't tell them. I would deny it. Oh, everything's good. It's great. Everything's wonderful. And on one trip that they made up to see me, I had a black eye. And my dad said to me, Rosie, what's with your eye? And I said, oh, you know, I was bent over doing something, and Mark opened the door, and the knob hit me in the eye, and my father looked at me, and he said, baby, you got one time to tell me that story. And I knew it was probably not a good idea to lie to them anymore. But I couldn't tell them the truth, because I had no intention of stopping drinking. See, drinking has always been my solution to any problem, good, bad, life. I have no coping skills. I drink. That's who I am. That's what I do. Eventually, I couldn't take the abuse anymore, and I was getting ready to leave because it was him, and it was that, and I knew if I left, everything would just be magically better, and I got the courage. I said, screw this, I'm out. I got to go. I can't do this anymore. I'm sick all the time. I'm emotionally sick. I'm physically sick, because I was a physically sick alcoholic. I threw up every single day that I drank. If I drank last night, I threw up the next morning every single time. So when they talk about the allergy to alcohol, it took me a long time to figure out, oh, I got sick. Oh. It's really just that simple, Rose. I got sick every time I drank. So I was getting ready to leave him, and he fell down a flight of stairs, and he broke his neck. And now he was partially paralyzed, and I couldn't. I was so ashamed that what would they think of me if I left him? What if somebody had done that to me? What if somebody left me when I was at the absolute worst part of my life? What would people think of me? And I stayed with him, and I don't know how long I stayed with him for. I think it was a year. I'm not sure. And he continued to drink after he got out of rehab. He was in a walker. He was, like I said, he had limited use of all four limbs. And the reason he continued to drink is because I bought it for him. I continued to supply him because if I didn't give him alcohol, my life was miserable. And I needed peace and quiet when I got home. I just wanted to be left alone. And I could ensure that if I gave him alcohol. So I would dole out certain amounts. You can have this much. I might still have a couple of control issues, but you can have this much at this time, and that's what I did. And eventually, it was just I couldn't do it anymore, and he had had another GI bleed, and he was rushed to the hospital, and my mother had come up from Florida to visit myself and my two brothers, and she actually went with me to the hospital to see him. And when she saw me, she knew that I was in trouble. Something about a mother's ability to look in your soul. And she was still under the impression that he was probably the problem. And all I know is I went into that hospital and we were in a relationship. When I came out, I was no longer in a relationship with him anymore. My mother broke up with him. I don't know how she did it. She's 4'11", tough as nails. And then I thought, okay, great. Now my life starts. I'm 33 years old. Woo. And you know what changed? Absolutely nothing. He was no longer in the picture. I couldn't blame him anymore. I left him in that hospital. And my life was not any better. I was still as lonely. I was still as angry. I was still drinking. And I knew drinking was the problem because I had nothing else to blame. I knew it. I knew my alcoholism was the root of my problems, but I couldn't stop. I didn't know how to stop. I used to tell myself on the way home from work, whatever you do, don't stop at the liquor store. I'd be in the parking lot. Whatever you do, don't go inside. I'd go inside, and if it was going to snow, I'd buy four bottles because God and a carton of cigarettes. God forbid I get stuck in a snowstorm and I don't have booze. And then I'd get home and I'd pour the drink, and my drinks were 20-ounce solo cups. That much whiskey and a little bit of Sprite on top with a straw because it's one sip. The whole thing is one sip. That's how much of a pig I am when I drink. There's nothing nice about me when I drink alcohol. And sometimes I'd throw it up and I'd drink it right back down until I could calm myself. I couldn't drink during the day, not because I didn't want to, but because I was so physically sick from the night before. And my drinking just kept getting worse and worse. I wet the bed every single night. I don't think I ever slept. I passed out. I don't remember the whole decade of the 80s. I'm a huge blackout drinker. So I knew the problem was alcohol, but it never occurred to me that I could have a life without it. That's all I knew. I was so sad. I was so lonely. I was so desperate. I started hanging around with some people that I worked with who were much younger than I, and they were kind of social because I was not a social person. I was a closet hermit alcoholic. And I didn't do anything. I didn't go to the movies. I didn't do anything. And I started doing little things. Like I'd go to the movie at 10:30 in the morning with me and a six-year-old watching Free Willy, you know. And she's saying, lady, it's going to be all right. Don't cry. And I'm like, in the back aisle. And then maybe I'd go shopping. But I'd have to be home at 4 o'clock because 4 o'clock, that's go time. That's when it starts. Because I couldn't start too early because I pass out too early and then I'd be up in the middle of the night. My life, alcohol dictated if I did it, if I didn't do it, it dictated every single thing I ever did. So I started hanging around with these people and they'd ask me if I wanted to go out one night. And I didn't do that. I wasn't a bar drinker for a variety of reasons. I don't like bar drinks. They're little. I can't drink the way I want to in public because I have truly live in this bubble where I don't think anybody knows I'm an alcoholic because I hide it. I didn't realize that when you drink that much whiskey, it's got to come out somewhere. I probably smelled like a freaking brewery every day at work, but I'm so busy spraying Victoria's Secrets and Bath and Body Works all over me, I don't think they smell it over the pear. You know what I mean? It's whiskey. So, but I was delusional and I didn't think anybody knew, but whatever. So I decided to do what I don't ever do, and I decided to go out socially with some friends. And it was November 25th, 1998, and it was the night before Thanksgiving. And being an older woman, I was, I think at this time I'm around 35, somewhere around there. I didn't know that the night before Thanksgiving was a very big night out in the bars. All the kids come home from college. So when we got there, and we got there about 9 o'clock at night, it was crowded, it was packed, you couldn't get near the bar, so I'm miserable. Because I don't like people, because I'm a social misfit. I don't want anybody touching me. And the fact of the matter is I wasn't having a good time because I couldn't drink the way I wanted to drink. I'm paying good money for bad drinks. It doesn't make much sense to an alcoholic. You know what I mean? So, of course, I'd had a couple of drinks before I went to the bar, but by no stretch of the imagination did I enjoy myself. So I did my little cursory couple hours with my friends, and I said, I'm going to head home. I've had enough. Thanks a lot. I'm out. And the reason I knew is because I have this calculator of a mind that tells me I have to get out of here, I have to get home, I have to get drunk, I have to pass out, I have to be able to get up the next morning, get sick, make myself look presentable to spend Thanksgiving with my brother and his family. Because I can't drink around any family. They don't know I'm an alcoholic. So I had to have all these things done, so I had to leave. So it never occurred to me when I left the bar that night that I shouldn't drive. I'm a professional alcoholic. I've had a couple of drinks. I'm not impaired at all. In my personal opinion. So, which doesn't matter at all. And so it never occurred to me when I put the key in the ignition and started to drive away that that was a bad choice. And I'm cognizant of making that choice. I wasn't too drunk to make that choice. I knew what I was doing. I got in the car and I started to drive home, and I almost made it home that night. Almost. I lived 17.3 miles from this bar, and I was literally around the corner from my apartment. And I dropped a cigarette. I was smoking at the time. And I lived in a very rural part of northwest New Jersey. It was like a country road. No sidewalks, no streetlights. It was a rainy night. And when I bent over to pick up my cigarette, I hit something. And I thought I hit a deer. And I never stopped. And I didn't check. I kept going. And one of the reasons was because I was instantly afraid of whatever it was. And that the police station was about 100 yards down on the left-hand side because that's the way my life is. If I'm going to hit something, I'm going to do it almost right in front of the cop shop. So I never stopped, turned the corner, pulled my car into the parking lot and went inside. When I'd hit what I truly, and I'm being honest when I say this, I truly thought I hit a deer because I lived in that part of an area. Lots of deer. There was even brown bear. I mean, it was kind of hicky where I lived. When I'd hit this, my windshield imploded, and it was raining that night. So when I got in and I got into my apartment, I was talking to a friend of mine. I said, I hit a deer a couple streets up, and my windshield imploded. I need to put something over my windshield. And he said, I have a tarp in the garage, Rose. This is no big deal. I'll drive it over, and I'll help you cover your windshield. And within 10 minutes, true to his word, there he was, saw him pull in, and him and I walked out, and he went on one side of the car, and I went on the other, and we went to drape this tarp over my car to, you know, because I'm materialistic, I might ruin my interior. On the upper passenger side corner of the windshield, there was a tuft of hair and a piece of a human forehead. And I panicked. And I said, please take me back. And he did. I got in his truck and we turned the corner, and that's how close it was. You know, you always hear that these things happen so close to where you are, and it was just that close. And as soon as we turned the corner, I could see that there was police cars and I could see that there was an ambulance, and I knew that they don't call an ambulance for a deer, and I knew it was serious. And now I have this man with me, and I panicked again. I didn't want to get him in trouble. So I said, please take me home. And he did. He turned his truck around. He dropped me off. He went home, and I went inside, and I did what every good alcoholic would do, and I poured myself a drink. And I kept drinking for the next 2 hours because, you see, I knew that they would find me. I knew that there would be a knock on my door. I knew that there would be a policeman on the other side of it. And I knew that whatever just happened was going to be life-altering. I didn't run. I didn't hide my car. I just waited. And eventually, after a couple hours, there was that knock and there was that policeman. And he said, "Miss Eshman, it looks as though your vehicle's been in an accident. We need to bring you in for questioning." And they did. After 5 hours or more, they told me that I'd struck and killed a 45-year-old man that was walking in the road. And I didn't see him because I didn't stop. And I didn't see him because I didn't check. I knew my life was never going to be the same. I knew the jig was up. I knew it was over. Everything's over. And I knew the only answer for me was to commit suicide. It was my only chance. I was bailed out of the police station that night because the detectives didn't want to see somebody like me go to jail, and they begged me to please have a friend come up with some money. They even called the judge themselves. The detectives called the judge and had him lower my bail so it was affordable. A friend showed up on Thanksgiving Day with a wad of cash and bailed me out, and I walked home from the police station. My brother was somewhere behind me in a station wagon screaming at me, but I walked home, and I knew that I had to end this because it was over. I knew whatever was going to happen in my life is far too difficult for me to handle. I knew that I would never be able to get past the blackness in my soul for what I had done and what I was responsible for. And I went on a mission to kill myself. Of course, now my parents know, everybody knows, it's in the paper. And my mother and father begged me to please do two things. Get psychiatric help, because they knew I was teetering. I was going for it. And they said, get an attorney, Rose. You're going to need one. And I did both those things. I checked myself into a psychiatric unit. They kept me for 11 days. At the end of 11 days, they said, "You're not well enough to go home by yourself, Rose." And they were right. And so they made me go to this residential living facility for adults in crisis. And I did. I went to this facility, and I did what I thought made perfect sense. I had an affair with my counselor. And as soon as I got out, I don't think I was out a couple of weeks, I moved in with him, and I was drinking again. I tried going to a couple AA meetings, but it wasn't for me. The only thing that was going to end this was ending this. I was so hopeless, and I was so dead inside that I didn't think I could ever get past it. I used to drive to the scene of the accident 6 times a day, sometimes more. And I would just look and say, "How could this have happened?" And then I would think, "What do you mean, Rose? You've been a train wreck your whole life." It just caught up to me. And then I couldn't stand to live in my own skin. The only way I could get through a day was to drink. And I kept trying to commit suicide 3 or 4 times, and somebody would always find me. And nothing was working. Eventually, this guy said to me, "Rose, if you don't stop drinking, you're just going to have to leave." And I don't take very well to people giving me ultimatums. So he went to the liquor store, and he went to work. I went to the liquor store. And he told me I had to leave, and I did. I came down here to Florida, which is technically bail jumping because I was out on bail. I was out on bail for 2.5 years because I decided to take my case to trial. And it was never a matter of innocence or guilt for me. I knew I was guilty. I thought if I could go into a courtroom and I could let this man's parents see me and his family see me, and I could say I was sorry for what I had done, that it would somehow alleviate the blackness in my soul. But it took 2.5 years to get there. And during that time, I couldn't live comfortably in my own skin if I wasn't anesthetized in some way. So when he threw me out, I had nowhere else to go. I informed my attorney I'd be going to Florida, and I did. I moved down to Florida with my parents. And that was the beginning of the end. I just figured, well, jig's up here. I'm going to have to do it right in their spare bedroom. You know, I'm going to have to end it all. And I went on a mission to kill myself. And my parents did everything they could to save me. They watched me. They loved me. They used to take me to this place called Wikiwachi to watch the sunset and just spend time with me. And I didn't realize how precious a gift that was that they gave me of their time and their love just to try to keep me out of my own way. Eventually, my brother-in-law, who had found sobriety in AA, came to a family dinner because I wanted no part of this happy horse shit. I didn't want anything to do with it. And he was high on AA, you know, loving it, going to meetings, chairing meetings, blah, 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 blah. And he looked across the dinner table at me and he said, hey, Rose, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. Why don't you come with me? And I've never hated him as much as I hated him at that moment. I hated him. And I knew when my father, again, like I was 17 all over again, just looked at me over the top of his glasses and said, baby, I don't think you have a choice. And I went to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Florida. Couldn't pick my head up, looked at my shoes, cried for 3 weeks, and every day this guy showed up. And he took me to another meeting. And he showed up, and he took me to another meeting. And eventually I could get more than, my name is Rose and I'm an alcoholic, passed out of my mouth, because I couldn't look at you, because I was so ashamed of me. But eventually, when your head starts to clear and you start doing the next right thing and you don't drink and you get a sponsor, you start to see that maybe there's a little flicker of hope, just a little bit. And I got that little flicker of hope. Unfortunately, I also got the idea that getting back together with this guy in New Jersey was a good one. And I started making trips back and forth to New Jersey, you know, because he becomes my higher power again and blah, blah, blah. AA is not important. He's going to fix me. See, everything fixes me. Men fix me. Money fixes me. Shoes fix me. Cars fix me. Everything fixes me. Alcohol wasn't fixing me anymore, so this guy had to fix me. And on one of the trips, I was there. I got a call from my sister. It said, Dad's really sick. You got to get home. And I came home, and within a month, my father died. The blessing in that, and the reason I mention that, is I was sober when my father passed away. And that was a gift. Because if my life not gone the way it went, if this whole thing hadn't happened, I wouldn't have been there holding his hand when he left this world. Getting an opportunity to tell him, I am sorry for the things that I did to hurt you. And I was sober and I did it. And I'm grateful that I had that opportunity. Not long after we buried my dad, I decided that, you know, my trial was coming up in a few months, and I helped my mother get her life in order, and I got on a plane and I went back to New Jersey because I was going to spend my last couple of months before trial with this man because, again, I'm in love. You know how it goes. And that's what I did, and I don't think my my feet were on the ground in New Jersey when I started drinking again. And I also knew I was pregnant. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't take a test. I knew. The women in the audience may understand this. I knew. I've never been married. I've never had children, but I knew. And I didn't tell anybody, and I didn't stop drinking. And I didn't tell anybody, and I did other things. And I didn't tell anybody. And eventually he gave me that same ultimatum. If you drink again, I will put you on a plane to Florida. He went to work. I went to the liquor store. The next day I was on a plane back to Florida. He was true to his word. He paid $750 one way to get rid of me. And I cried the whole way. I think they put an air marshal next to me because they thought I was going to do something on the plane. And I landed in Tampa, and I went right to the bar, and I sat there with two big 7-and-7s, and my sister walked in with my AA sponsor, and she said, how are you doing? And I said, I'm drunk. How are you? And she said, I'm pretty good and a little better than you. And I said, and I think I'm pregnant. And that's the only time I ever uttered those words. As soon as I got back to Florida, I started going back to AA. What I didn't do is I didn't stop drinking. I would illegally drive my mother's car because the state of New Jersey has already taken my license away because I was involved in an accident with a fatality. They'll take it away for 3.5 years. I have no license, but I'm taking my mother's car, who's a recent widow, going to the liquor store and then going to an AA meeting, watching the clock, hoping nobody knows my name in the room, for 9 o'clock to come so I can get out of there and go home and get drunk. And I did that for months. I went to a meeting every single night, and right after that meeting I got drunk. And I cannot tell you the torture of living that kind of a lie in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, to be using and to sit in a room where there's people actually recovering and to know that you have nothing to share, so please don't call on me. And you're not able to tell anybody you're a liar because you're a liar. You can't look anybody in the eyes because you're dishonest. And eventually it came time to go to New Jersey, and I stood trial. My trial was 3.5 weeks long. During the course of the trial, I miscarried. It was a blessing. God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And then I was coupled with the guilt. I'm on trial for killing a man because I choose to drink and drive. And now I've killed this innocent fetus. And at the end of a 3-week period where my mother and my uncle pretty much were on me the whole time, I was found guilty. And I was escorted to the county jail. I could get bailed out pending my sentence. And I begged my mother. I called her probably 50 times on that first day and begged her to please get me out of jail. It was only $50,000. You know, don't you have that in your back pocket? If it was one of your sons, you'd get them out of jail. And I called her and I'd hang up on her. I'd call her and I'd hang up on her. And there was no bond, $50,000 cash. because I was a flight risk, because I'd been living in Florida, jumping bail. Of course I'm a flight risk. And eventually she came to the county jail, and she looked at me, and she said, "Rosellen, I love you, but I'm going to save your life. I'm not getting you out of jail." And my attorney said, "Isabel, you can do this." And she said, "Are you going to watch her? Are you going to save her from killing herself?" And she let me sit for there for 4.5 months. Eventually, in June of 2001, I was sentenced to 12 years and 30 days in the state penitentiary. 8 days later, I was shipped off to the only female penitentiary in the state of New Jersey. It's only one. Everybody's there. And I knew as soon as I got in there and they dumped me and I heard that gate slam that I was never going to make it. I can't do that. I'm not like them. I was exactly like them. I had made a choice that had a consequence, and all I was doing was getting my consequence. But not me. I remember the first week, and they put you in a big gymnasium, and there's 64 beds, 32 bunk beds, and you're with everybody. They don't sort you out at first in the beginning where I was, so you're in there with everybody. No matter what they did, you're in there with them until they sort you out. And I remember just screaming and crying into my pillow, thinking, I'll never get through this. I'll never get through this. And for the first 3 years of my sentence, I spent it in the maximum security part of the prison. Because in New Jersey, my crime is a violent crime. I'm a violent offender because my car became my weapon. And for the first 3 years, I was angry. 2 years in, the man I had been seeing broke up with me. He couldn't handle it anymore. And I'm thinking, you can't handle it anymore. What do you have to handle? Because I couldn't see that for everything that I was going through, other people have their own set of issues that they deal with in life. For every bar in my prison, he had a responsibility. And it was the greatest gift he could have given me, but I couldn't see it at that time, and I was angry. And there was no AA in the maximum security part of this prison. There was Al-Anon, which floors me. Okay, because 85% of your people incarcerated are there for drug or alcohol-related crimes. So you give them a program like Al-Anon, and no offense to Al-Anon, I'm not here because my mother drinks. So I was pissed. So I was angry, and I stayed angry, and I knew I would drink again. Never in that first three-year period had it occurred to me that I would stop drinking. I was clean. I didn't use in prison. And I didn't use for one reason. Not because I'm a saint and I made the choice to be sober and, oh, this is so bad, I never want this to happen again. I made the choice because there wasn't enough. I couldn't get enough of what I needed to make it worthwhile. There wasn't enough drugs, there wasn't enough booze to make this worthwhile, because I'm getting caught. And they're throwing me in solitary confinement, so I better be drunk for a week. I'm not giving you all my money that I have for a little half pint. I'm not doing it. So it's the fact that I'm an absolute glutton that kept me clean for 3 years. After 3 years, I was classified to the minimum part of the prison, and I got involved in a program called Puppies Behind Bars. And it's a program where inmates raised dogs for law enforcement. And I hadn't seen a dog. I hadn't seen a tree. I hadn't seen a car. I hadn't seen anything in 3 years. Where I was very barren. It was dirt and, you know, six layers of barbed wire. And I got to this other part of the prison that's within the same compound, yet it was entirely different. I had more freedom. And I thought this program would help me. I thought it would get me out of my own way. Because the time was starting to do me. And I was so angry. And I knew as soon as I got out, I would drink again. I knew where I would buy it. I knew where I would hide it. I knew that I would be the same alcoholic I always was. So I decided to get involved in this program, and I realized after I started working with dogs that I loved it, and I'd never known that about myself. And after about 4 or 5 months in the program, they gave me my own dog to raise. They gave me an 8-week-old black Labrador retriever named Sandy. And they put this little puppy in my arms, and my whole world changed. I hadn't felt love in a very long time. I didn't know what love was. Because I build these huge walls around me to protect me from you. But what it does is it keeps me from everything and keeps all the rotten, poison, toxic things in there with me. All the fear, all the pain, all the hate, all the shame. It's in there with me. And this little dog started to take the bricks out of this wall one by one. And I had my very first spiritual awakening in my cell, because this dog was with me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I looked at her. And she looked back at me, and I knew she loved me. And I knew she loved me, and she didn't care what I had done, who I had hurt, what I'd looked like. She loved me for me. And it gave me this little flicker of hope. And one of my friends in Florida had actually come from Florida to New Jersey to visit me while I was in maximum security, and she brought me all this AA literature, the big book, Living Sober, all this crap that I shoved under my bed because I don't want it. And I kept it because that seed had been planted in me somewhere. AA was there somewhere. And once I thought there was a little hope for me, I pulled it all out and I started reading it. And in the minimum security part of the prison, they did have AA meetings, and I started going. And it's different. It's not like out here. But I got to learn things like what it meant for me to take what I need and leave the rest. And I did the best that I could. Eventually, after 6 years and 3 days, I was granted parole. And I was granted parole via the Interstate Compact, and I was allowed to come to Florida, which I didn't think that was going to happen either, because I'm the glasses completely empty alcoholic. Nothing good happens to me. I'm cynical and I'm negative. And when they said I got parole and I got to Florida, I was shocked. All I remember is my brother picking me up on February 5th, 2007 at the Edna Mann Correctional Facility for Women and dropping me off at Newark Airport. And all I had on was gray sweatpants, a gray T-shirt, and a khaki coat that said inmate, and a stack of paperwork with my airline ticket and some ID. And I remember walking over to the front of the airport, and I said goodbye and thanks, and I was scared to death. And I remember it was 10 below zero in New Jersey, and I took my coat off that said inmate, and I stuffed it in the garbage can, and I walked inside. And I became so filled with fear. I didn't know what to do. It had been so long since I'd had the ability or the reason to think for myself. I was institutional. I was used to institutionalized. I was used to somebody telling me what to do. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. So eventually I just went with the flow and I followed these people and we got to the security checkpoint and she's two ladies in front of me and I'm standing there, you know, in my convict outfit with my little packet of information waiting to get through this big checkpoint, which I wasn't used to because 9/11 had happened when I was in prison and now it was very cumbersome to get through the airport and I wasn't used to it and I was filled with fear that they wouldn't let me through. That they were going to know. Some kind of major bell was going to go off when I walked through the metal detectors. Convict, convict, convict. And I was scared to death. And I'm standing there waiting for my time to go through the metal detectors. And these women are just bitching. I got to take my shoes off. I got to take my shoes off. And I'm sitting there thinking, my security checkpoints are far more invasive. And I will strip naked, bend over, lift them up, and cough right here, right now. Let me through. Oh, they didn't want all that, but I got through. And I ate everywhere in the whole airport. I ate everywhere. Anyway, got on a plane, got to Florida, went to live with my sister, and filled with fear, overwhelmed. The day I was released from prison, I started a 15-year loss of license. That was part of my sentence. It started the day I came out. So now I am a convicted felon, on parole, can't drive. Now I have to look for work. Filled with fear. If I don't get a job, I can't pay my fines. If I can't pay my fines, I'm going back to prison. I didn't even know how to turn my sister's TV on. I used to ask her if I could take a shower. I was so tied up in knots. But I knew that I knew that I knew that I had to get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, because I know me. I know if left to my own devices, I will drink again. I never needed AA to stop drinking. I needed AA to stay stopped. Because I've stopped drinking 100 times. Thousands of times, I can't stay stopped. Because the minute I hit a bump in the road, the minute my life is too bad or too good, I drink. And I knew I couldn't do that again. I knew I couldn't do that again. Because I will become a sick, suicidal alcoholic again. I know that. So I went to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when I got out of prison. And as God would have it, when I opened that door, the very first person I saw on the other side of the door was the very woman who had flown from Florida to New Jersey to bring me the AA material. That was my first God experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't like sharing in meetings. I have a very hard time doing it. My sponsor smacks me on the leg. She yells at me. She does all kinds of things. But for whatever reason, that first meeting that I went to, when they said, "Is anybody newer coming back?" my hand went up in the air. I became only as willing as the dying can be. And I said, "My name is Rose, I'm an alcoholic, and I just got out of prison." And I used to sit there in the back, petrified, but I didn't know what else to do. So I just kept going. And I got to understand what it meant one day at a time, because I hated all your slogans. I got to tell you. Feelings aren't facts. Let me tell you something. When I'm feeling it, it's a fact. I hated it. I got don't drink and go to meetings. I got that. I got one day at a time. I got that. Think, think, think. What do you mean, think, think, think? That's all I do is think, 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 think. That's all I'm doing. I didn't get those things. And the ones I didn't get, I didn't understand. And the one I didn't understand, I didn't know how to do. So what I could do is not drink and go to meetings. And that's what I did. And they said, get a temporary sponsor. And I did. And then they said, get a real sponsor, Rose. And I looked around the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for somebody that had what I wanted. Because they had to be serious about Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I can't do this halfway. I got to love this gig. Or I'm not doing this gig. And if I don't do this gig, I'm not going to be lucky enough to die. I'm going to have to live again the way I was living, and I can't do that. I'm not willing to do that anymore. So I kept looking, and I kept waiting, and I kept listening, and I kept watching. And eventually, I was quite certain that this woman would want nothing to do with me because I'm a piece of garbage. Because I'm known as, you know, that's Rose who went to prison. I'm that girl. I'm in the back. That was me. And eventually, I had enough courage to go up to this woman and say, would you be my sponsor? And she said, I was hoping you would ask. And that's a huge turning point in my life. She did for me what I could not do for myself. She didn't just drag me to meetings. She dragged me to Walmart. She took me to the post office. She made me go to the jail to put money on somebody's commissary books. I'd say to her, I'm coming out of my skin. I don't know what I'm going to do. She'd say, clean your sock drawer. And I thought that was code for something big. I'd say, okay, what does that one mean? She goes, Rose, dump the socks on the floor, take them apart, refold them, and put them back in. And I'm like, what, is she kidding me? And I'd say, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm thinking too much. She'd say, let's go out and mow the lawn. I'm coming over with my weed whacker. It sounds funny, but this woman kept me busy and distracted from myself. I will never be able to repay her for the things that she did to me by keeping me busy. I cannot talk to anybody enough about the importance of sponsorship. She saved my life because I will drink again. She started making suggestions because sponsors don't give advice. They give suggestions, which means you better do it. And the first one was go to women's meetings. Well, when you've been in prison for 6 years and 3 days, the last thing you're looking for is a woman's meeting, let me tell you that. Because, again, I'm on a manhunt. I'm looking for a man. Let's look around the room. Let's look for a man. He's a good one right there. And then you find out 3 years later, thank God for unanswered prayers because he's as sick as they come. But whatever. And I did what she wanted me to do, and I went to women's meetings. And she started working the steps with me, and my life started to change. I couldn't find a job for a long time because it's not easy when you have your life that you tote behind you. And I met this woman at a meeting, and my friend says, ask her for a ride. She's good about giving you a ride. She'll give you a ride to a meeting. And so she passed her little number across the table and said, if you ever need a ride, call me. And I thought, oh, God, I hate asking anybody for anything because I'm so independent. Here I am. I can't drive. I can't go anywhere. I need to ask anybody for everything. So I eventually call up this woman, and I say to her, you know, you think maybe you could give me a ride to a meeting? And she says, I'll pick you up. So the first week she picks me up for the meeting, which is now my home group. And she said, so how's the job search going? And I said, well, not too good. Not very good at all. I'm scared. I'm fearful. I'm not going to pay my fines. I'm going to get my parole revoked, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, this place is hiring. And I'm like, okay, whatever. And so next week she picks me up for the meeting, and she's like, so how's the job search going? And I'm like, well, not so good. You know, I'm doing a little bit of house cleaning, and I'm working at the car wash one day a week. I think I earned a big $49 that week. And I said, not real good. And she said, well, this place is hiring. You should really call this place and see if they're hiring. And I said, yeah, okay, whatever. And the next week she picks me up, and she says to me, how's the job search going? And I said, not very good, blah, blah, blah. And she said, this place is hiring. And I said, what is this place? She says, I own it. Show up on Thursday. My sponsor assured me the program of Alcoholics Anonymous will meet all of my needs. All of my needs, emotional, financial, and it has. When I first came into AA, I had no higher power other than the rooms themselves. And it wasn't because I didn't have a belief in God or a deep faith, because I did. What I was so ashamed of the woman I was, so filled with shame, that I couldn't connect with the God of my childhood, who's the God in my life today, but I couldn't connect with him because I was so ashamed of who I was. I even went to confession because I'm a good Catholic girl. When I got out of prison and I dumped on the priest for an hour and 20 minutes, they had to bring him back up, make sure the priest was all right, and I didn't feel any better when I got out. But I felt better when I did my fifth step with my sponsor. I even felt better the second time I did my fifth step with my sponsor, which I just recently did. You know why? And it was harder. Because these are the things I did in sobriety. Without benefit of a drink or a drug to blame it on, I did this in sobriety. I can still cause harm in sobriety. Who would have thunk it? I have a life today that is beyond my wildest dreams. All of my needs have been met. I no longer am on a manhunt because you see what happened? When I stopped looking, he found me. And he is a sober man that I met in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I have found out is I need Al-Anon. I need Al-Anon because there's not enough time in the day for me to take my inventory and his. And I love him with all my heart. And I have everything that I never thought would bring me joy, happiness, and serenity. I have a freedom today that is beyond belief. I don't wake up and wonder what I did or who I did it to. I don't have big gaping black holes in my life. I know what happened yesterday. I may not remember what I had for dinner last Thursday, but I'm pretty sure I didn't do any harm in my life today because I can still cause harm. I have had an opportunity in the back half of my life to become the woman I was always meant to be. I'm not creating this new image. This is who I was supposed to be all along before I chose to live a different way. I never thought the life that I had today was possible for someone like me. I'm a sick, sick woman. And yet, I find the greatest joy in my life, and it's all a benefit of the programs of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have friends who love me for who I am. I have a family that talks to me and trusts me today. I can become an active and trusted member of society. There may are people out there, and I have come across them, that will never see me for anything else other than the crime that I committed. And that's okay. Because I know they don't see me. I've learned in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have tools to use today that I never had before. Recently, a very dear friend of mine, Laura, asked me to apply for a job in a public supermarket. And I went in and I was granted an interview with the manager of the store. And the reason I'm looking for another job is I'm looking for benefits. I can't see. I got to get to the doctor. I'm old, so I thought I need a job with benefits. I don't have them where I am. I'm lucky to have a job, don't get me wrong. I'm incredibly grateful. But I'm old. I need some things. So she convinces me to do it. I get an interview with the store manager, which is farther than I've ever gotten in the last 4 years. He offers me a job. And 10 days later tells me he has to renege the offer because of my background check. And I cried for about a minute. And then I realized that God has a better plan for me. I only know that because of this program. I would never have known that had I not kept showing up. My life has ups, my life has downs. The only thing I do is I just don't drink. I work a program. Some days I don't work one at all. Some days the only thing I do right is I just don't drink. And that's enough to get me through. Somebody told me a long time ago, your head will lie to you, Rose. It will lie to you. The only way out is through. So I keep showing up. AA teaches me to do the uncomfortable until it becomes comfortable. And that's what I do. I am so lucky and so blessed to have an opportunity to share a little bit of who I am with you today. I can't tell you what it does for me. It's very hard for me. I'm very much of a social misfit. So it's hard for me to open up to new people. I'm the one that's usually looking at my shoes. I'm the one standing on the outside of the crowd. So for me to be able to do this, it helps me more than you'll ever know, and I'm very grateful to have that opportunity. God has given me a life today that I do not deserve. One of my biggest dreams was when I got out of prison was that I'd be able one day to bring the program of Alcoholics Anonymous into prison, and I was assured that that will never happen. Every year since I've been out, I've been applying. Please let me in. Please let me in. I'm still on parole, right? It's not going to happen. You're a convicted felon. It's not going to happen. About 10 months ago, I took my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous into the local prison. Right. That does more for me than I can possibly describe to you in words. And I met three women who were there for the very crime that I committed. And I'm living proof that if you don't drink one day at a time, life's a do-over. If you don't drink one day at a time, you will be able to look at yourself in the mirror and not hate what you see on the other side. I'm living proof of that because of this program. I have the best life I never wanted. And it's all because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, keep coming. If you have doubts, keep coming. If your life sucks, don't drink and go to a meeting. That's all there really is to it. At the end of every time I speak, I like to read a little something. And this was something that was given to me when I was leaving prison. It was given to me by one of the trainers in the puppy program that changed my life. God speaks through people and animals, in my opinion, and I am so eternally grateful that I was able to have this little puppy save my life. And I believe that. My God today is a little bit different, but that was my first God awareness. And this, to me, kind of sums up what Alcoholics Anonymous means. Two rows. It says, people are often unreasonable and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you are honest, people may cheat you. Be honest anyway. If you find happiness, people may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today may be forgotten tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you have to offer, and it may never be enough, but give your best anyway. For you see, in the end, it's between you and God. It was never about them anyway. I would just like to close by saying the thing that reached me in Alcoholics Anonymous was the language of the heart. It was your heart speaking to my heart. And I hope tonight somehow I've managed to touch some of your hearts. Thank you for the opportunity to share.